It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of community members gathered for a candlelight vigil at the state capitol Tuesday night, grieving a school shooting in Madison that took the life of a student and teacher. Six people were wounded at Abundant Life Christian School as well on Monday.
And I know he watches me. His eyes on the space.
As authorities continue to search for motives and answers as to how the 15-year-old student was able to access the handguns, we hear now from Sandy Hook Promise.
Mark Barden is co-CEO and co-founder of this anti-gun violence group that he formed in 2013 after his first grade son, Daniel, was killed with 19 other children and six educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Mark, thank you for being here.
Kate.
Mark, what words can you offer in this moment as the school and the community is grieving its losses?
That I've been thinking about you, the community has been thinking about you, my heart goes out to you. It's just such a horrific, senseless, preventable tragedy. And if there's ever a time that I could be of any consolation or an ear or shoulder to cry on, I'm here for you. And it's just, it's devastating to witness this happening again and knowing the life-changing journey that these folks are going to be embarking on right now.
327, it's the number of school shootings this year to date. That's according to a national K-12 school shooting database. Abundant Life Christian School, that is, this year marks Wisconsin's deadliest year on record. What advice do you have for families and school communities as they try to heal and really wrestle with this grief and anger?
It's just that there is no way to, there's no wrong way to move through this. There, I can't even say that there's a healing or a resolution other than, accept the help from folks who are there for you, your friends and family, who don't know what to do, who can't take your pain away, but want to do anything they can to make your life easier. Let them do that. It will be helpful to you, and it gives them a sense of purpose and meaning. Understand that there's no wrong way to move through this. Just do this at your own pace. Rely on the love and the support of others if you have that luxury in your life. And know that we're out there working to prevent this from happening to other folks.
I want to get to Sandy Hook Promise in just a moment, but I also want to ask you about digital media. You know, some people and kids, they're living this tragedy through their online social media channels. And as you're well aware, toxic conspiracy theories rose up around the Sandy Hook massacre. What do you say about going online to process a tragedy?
Once again, I think it's whatever works for you. If there's comfort in that, I would definitely steer clear of that element that may surface here as well. It certainly did with Sandy Hook, and I would just do your best to avoid that and ignore that. There's no good in it. It's nothing healthy in there. But in whatever way. Maybe folks engage in their hobbies or looking at photos of family or whatever you find to be helpful. If that's the path you take, try stuff out, see what works. Try to stay healthy and positive to the best of your ability. I know for us, we had to focus on making it as normal an existence for our surviving children as we possibly could. That's a lot of work all by itself, but it's kind of healthy, distracting work. We had mixed results. It was our younger children who were there accompanying us as much as we were able to be there for them. So you just have to move through this in whatever way works best for you.
Sandy Hook Promise is running this program that aimed to help authorities identify warning signs before someone commits an act of gun violence. Can you talk about the impact you're finding through this type of program?
Well, so, yeah, Kate, thanks for asking that. You know, we started this organization with the basic, simple concept of preventing other families from having to endure this lifetime of pain, and to see if there was a different approach that we could take that hadn't already been done, where we could truly focus on the essence of prevention. That led us to a lot of research where we learned that almost always folks talk about it first before they commit an act of violence, and they often talk about it to more than one person. And so all of those warning signs that are being exhibited, and this case looks to be the same, those are all opportunities to make an intervention and to connect that person to help. So imagine a world where everybody knew how to look for those warning signs and had the tools with which to connect somebody and the resources with which to connect somebody to help before it became a tragedy. That's what we're doing at Sandy Hook Promise. We bring these programs, these Know the Signs programs, into schools at no cost, train students, parents, and teachers how to recognize those warning signs, how to be a trusted adult to a student who sees warning signs either in themselves or others. And then that trusted adult can then connect that individual with whatever support or services they need. We have students trained in our Know the Signs programs have now prevented at least 16, possibly more, credible planned school shootings and countless acts of violence, over 700 suicides, just by using their knowledge from their training on how to recognize those warning signs and then connecting that person to a trusted adult who can get them to the help. And also, you know, good policy safety initiatives, safer access to firearms. You know, if you choose to own a firearm in your home, it should not be accessible to those who should not have access to it. We also support youth mental health and wellness programs and initiatives and policy. So there is a lot of things that we can do. We have a model that works. And it's so hard to say that this didn't have to happen, that it was preventable to folks who are living through this pain. Mm. It's, you know, I understand that dichotomy. Having, you know, living this myself, what happened to us in Sandy Hook was preventable. But we just need to get more folks trained. And, you know, folks in our communities aware of those warning signs and with the tools with to get them connected to help.
Mark Barden is with us, co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, the anti-gun violence group that he formed in 2013, as we talk about the Abundant Life Christian School shooting in Madison this week. Mark, I hear echoes of what you're saying in our conversation yesterday with the director of the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Office of School Safety. Trish Kilpin was here, and she said research even 25 years ago pointed to access to a confidential reporting system as being key to help prevent school attacks. And Wisconsin started its threat reporting line called Speak Up, Speak Out, or SUSO, in 2020.
What we're seeing is tremendous use of this system. We have received over 13,000 tips to SUSO. And yes, it does prevent violence. That is clear with the research. But we also see a real broad diffusion of benefits.
A broad diffusion of benefits. What importance do you see for states' efforts like Speak Up, Speak Out in preventing gun violence?
There's so much benefit from it, Kate, and as we just heard, a broad spectrum of benefit. We have our anonymous reporting system that's connected to our Say Something program, so students have access to a crisis center that's staffed with trained counselors who are multilingual, who have already connected with their district. So when a tip comes into the crisis center, they already know who all the folks on the ground in that district are, the administration, the school staff, the support systems in the area, the mental health services in the area. So they already know who to liaise with based on the nature of that tip. We've seen students using that, especially during the quarantine when they were at home and they weren't always in the safest place at home. 13-year-olds calling our crisis counselors in the middle of the night, just to have somebody to talk to who cared about them, who understood them. But they have made so many interventions and gotten help to where it's needed. Many of them folks, you know, young folks who were in the throes of suicide, who were actually in progress. Their crisis counselors were able to get help to them and keep them on the phone to de-escalate that situation and save their lives. We also see, and back to that broader value add that we see is students who are trained in these programs take this seriously. They take our Say Something program and the Start with Hello program seriously. They understand that they need to be an upstander for one another. We see a more connected culture, a more compassionate culture in the schools that we serve. We build the programs into clubs in the schools, so it's not just a training once in September and we're done. We build it into the culture and the climate of the school. So, in addition to stopping the bad things, we're also building and fostering a culture of upstanders who are more compassionate and more connected with one another.
It sounds as if it's really grassroots, coming up through the students and then, you know, training a generation of students in these values.
That's exactly right, Kate. We train students now in the kindergarten through 12th grade education universe, and they're continually retrained, and they build clubs, they build awareness events and activities around these simple programs that we don't charge them anything for it. We give it to the students. Students aren't being administered to from their administrators or their teachers. They are doing this themselves. They have the agency. They are empowered by this, and it's amazing to watch it work. They really take it seriously, and they do incredible work with these programs all year long, year after year. So it literally does become part of who they are. And when they go out into the world to start their own families, it just becomes part of who they are to be looking out for one another, to be telling a trusted adult, to be an upstander for one another.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And my heart goes out to the community there in Madison. Thanks for having me, Kate.
Mark Barden is co-CEO and co-founder of the Sandy Hook Promise. It's an anti-gun violence group that he formed in 2013 after the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Again, 3 digits, 988.
Coming up in the early 1900s, a Janesville woman created a cookbook that's still influencing dishes. It's called Practical Italian Recipes for American Kitchens.
I want to stress that practical aspect. If you look at the recipes, they are very short, just list of ingredients, very few steps.
Wisconsin's place in Italian culinary traditions. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A UW-Madison researcher introduces her students to Italian food culture by slowing down, savoring the moment, and trying out recipes for themselves.
The recipes come from 1917, when a woman from Janesville named Julia Lovejoy Cuniberti published an influential book about Italian cooking designed for American families.
She's affectionately known as Julia when Grazia Menichella talks about the central woman in her research and how Julia's thin cookbook made the Midwest an epicenter of Italian cooking traditions for decades to come.
Grazia Menichella is department chair and associate professor in the Department of French and Italian at UW-Madison. Grazia, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Take us back to the early 1900s when this Janesville woman publishes an influential cookbook, Practical Italian Recipes for American Kitchens. What was it like?
Well, let me tell you about Julia. I love Julia. My Julia, Lovejoy Cuniberti, grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin, studied at Vassar College, and then moved to Chicago. And she was a social worker at the Hull House. And this is really key, the work, as you know, that she was doing at the Hull House, because the Hull House, just like, you know, other neighborhood houses, was very engaged with migrants. and help migrants settle, including Italian Americans. So we're talking about Chicago, but she's familiar, of course, with the, you know, with the Midwest. And so they're assisting also Italian women to become citizens, learn English, to assimilate American culture, including American cuisine. And so while she's at the Hull House, she meets her future husband, Fernando Cuniberti, who is from a town in the region Emilia-Romagna in the north of Italy. And so she's living in Chicago when she published the cookbook in 1917. But in order to purchase the cookbook, you actually, as a reader, needed to send 50 cents with shipping information to Julia Lovejoy Cuniberti at 14 West Milwaukee Street, Genesee, Wisconsin. So there are only 56 recipes in this cookbook. So it's kind of a small, you know, project, let's say, a small cookbook. Yet, I think it's a very important cookbook that really had an impact in really promoting Italian cooking in the U.S. And so what is peculiar about this? Well, first of all, the title, Practical Italian Recipes for American Kitchens. Mm. So I want to stress that practical aspect. If you look at the recipes, they are very short, just list of ingredients, very few steps. She includes like suggestions. She has a foreword, but then she has suggestions in which she gives information like how to adapt the Italian dishes to
substitutions,
what to do, tomato paste, Parmesan cheese, dried mushrooms, anchovies, garlic.
And I want to stop you at garlic because she calls it inoffensive and wholesome and never disagreeable. How do you view this take on garlic?
Oh, this is fascinating. So she defines this kind of cooking, cucina casalinga, the cooking of the home. And so she's praising the Italian housewife that is able to cook with little that is available to her, something from the garden, seasonal, fresh ingredients. And she takes this label, Cucina Casalinga, the cooking of the home, from Pellegrino Artusi, who is like the most famous food writer in the history of Italian cuisine. So he published the book, Signs in the Kitchen and the Art of Eating Well, in 1891, where he promotes Cucina Casalinga. Mm-hmm. And so she's very much in line with what he's saying. Like the purpose of his book, which is to promote the cooking of the, you know, of the regular Italian household and also the cooking of the small restaurant. So we're not talking about chefs. We're not talking about fancy cuisine. We're talking about, you know, the trattoria, the osteria. And he has a lot to say about garlic. So Artusi in his book says, don't be afraid of garlic. Garlic is actually good for you. And so he talks about the benefits of garlic. And so garlic is always associated to Italian cuisine, but then it's also smelly and, you know, it's too much. And so even though I have to say Artusi promotes garlic and says, eat it, use it, it's good for you. Mm-hmm. When you read closely his recipes, he actually says, the right amount, not too much. So I feel that Julia has really engaged with the garlic question here in, you know, in Italian-American cuisine. So, so she gives very practical suggestions. And so she's promoting this model for the American cuisine. She's not really talking to Italian Americans. She's talking to Americans. She believed that Italian cuisine is the best, more economical, and more interesting than American cuisine. These are her words. Mm. And so we can learn, she says, from the, you know, from the Italian housewives, you know, what to do in the kitchen.
We are talking about the rich history of Italian culinary traditions in Wisconsin with Grazia Menichella, Associate Professor in the Department of French and Italian at UW-Madison. Let's go even more local here, an Italian-American community in Wisconsin that has been really upholding these food traditions and making new ones as we talk about the evolution. Tell us a bit about the history of the Greenbush neighborhood in Madison, mm-hmm. and also this area that was once known as Spaghetti Corners.
Okay. So the history of the Greenbush in Madison is very rich. And it's very important to me, and it should be important to all of us. the first club that was funded was in 1912. And so this was an association of the Italian Workmen's Club that decided to found this club in order to really create a support system for the community where they would pinch in, you know, and really help in those moments of need. And then 10 years later, 1922, they built the historical building that still stands strong at the corner of Park and Regent Street, the Italian Workmen's Club. And so that headquarters is still very active. In the basement, you have the Greenbush Bar that has recently been, you know, restructured and reopened under the leadership of Sam Brown. Upstairs is the headquarters of the Italian Workmen's Club. And this club is still very active. I had the pleasure of being there twice in the last few months. Once because they had their annual competition for tomato sauce, and I was one of the judges. That's, you know, a big highlight of my semester.
I bet.
And so the members, you know, they compete preparing, you know, their sauce.
Very
Cucina
serious.
Casalinga sauce, their own family recipe. And then it's followed by a dinner, of course, spaghetti and meatballs. And it was served also with the wine that the club still makes. And so you walk in and you see the wine press that, you know, I mean, should be in a museum. It's so beautiful. Oh. And so you're surrounded by all this history. On the wall, there is this huge Italian flag that the members in the early 20th century, again, they collect some money to buy and is preserved behind, you know, this glass. So, you know, it's really moving. I was particularly excited when 2 weeks ago I was able to conclude my semester on Sicily. So students read this novel set in Sicily, and then we went to the Italian Workmen's Club and we cooked in their kitchen in the club.
Wow.
It's a beautiful kitchen. And we made Sicilian dishes in the Sicilian headquarter, the dishes that the students have learned, you know, about by reading the novel.
Yeah.
And Angel Tripolin, who is the future president of the club, was there to welcome the students and talk about the history of the club. It doesn't get better than that. This is the Wisconsin idea.
It is their class coming alive.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So we hope to, you know, really strengthen even more. And hopefully to be able to preserve the history even more. There are some documents, a lot of photographs, of course, at the Historical Society. And then we have this beautiful, really important cookbooks by Catherine Tripoli Murray, local food writer of the Greenbush. And so her cookbook of the Greenbush is really both an important cookbook for the history of the Greenbush, because you get the map, you get the history, you learn about the Greenbush, but also the stories of the Greenbush, the stories of families, and the story of recipe.
As you're talking, it amazes me how cookbooks are such a clear lens into community and family and history and traditions, and all speaking this language through food. Why does food tell such a deep, important story?
Well, we are nurtured through food and language. Food is never just nourishment. It's not just, you know, feeding. And so when we talk about food, when you're getting a recipe, you're never just getting the ingredients at the steps. I would say even more in Italian culture, because conviviality is a key element of Italian food culture. Sharing, both, you know, the food that's on the table, but also the skills, the traditions, the preparation, and women are really key in all this. So really from one generation to the next.
Grazia, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
That was Grazia Menichella, associate professor in the Department of French and Italian at UW-Madison, where she researches and teaches about the history of Italian cooking and how these traditions are carried on today in places like Madison's Greenbush neighborhood. Now we head to Sheboygan, where a local chef is carrying the torch of Italian culinary traditions with a focus on slow food and high-quality produce. Stefano Biglietti is a self-taught chef who owns and operates three restaurants and a market in Sheboygan. Stefano, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kate. It's an honor to be here. Happy to join you.
Wisconsin has this rich history of Italian and Italian-American cooking throughout the state. You found it in your area in Sheboygan. Where do you see yourself in this tradition?
Well, I was sort of thinking about that as I was asked to do this, and I said, I'm not going to be your traditional through and through all the way Italian person because I'm half German and half Italian. So I always jokingly say that I am highly creative but punctual. So I'm trying. My German side keeps me in line, and my Italian side is flighty and creative and does more of that stuff. But I see myself as someone who's carrying on an incredibly important and ancient cuisine, which means so much to the world. And I do feel like someone that is helping foster and carry that forward. And I take it quite seriously, the commitment to authenticity.
In this through line of this incredibly important and ancient cuisine, how do you see that emerging in your kitchens among the chefs that you work with?
I think the most important thing that we have learned, and it took some time, it took me opening stinky packages of meat from, you know, standard places and wondering why it didn't taste like Italy and doing exactly the same thing I would see in Italy. I've taken over 40 or 50 of my staff there, and you try to learn and come back. And I kept trying to stay in the conventional supply chain and create those foods, and it wouldn't work. So we really had to change what we did and how we sourced to make it taste like Italy. That's the simplest way I can put it, is that even though we bring the most beautiful prosciuttos and mortadellas and parmigianos and all of these incredible ingredients from Italy, when it comes to shopping in your backyard, that's the thing that really struck me in Italy. We've been in Sicily on farms and eating in Tuscany and in Puglia in the south, and you're always, oh, this is my uncle's pig, it's my cousin's lamb, we grow this. All year long, the wild boar eats my crops. This was a place in Sicily. And then at the end of the year, I eat him. And we were sitting there eating that wild boar. And so for me, it was really about sourcing and the incredible importance of that before anything else. It's no mother sauce or long, slow cooking sauces and things. It's really about buy the most beautiful and pristine things and add a little sea salt and maybe some herbs and kind of get out of the way. And I know that sounds cliche, but that's real Italian cooking. It's very minimalistic.
So with that philosophy, how have your relationships changed with the local farmers who are around you, where you can source some of these ingredients from?
It's much easier to pick up the phone and call a mainline producer and say, bring me chickens, bring me beef, bring me this, bring me that. And it just shows up. The other way is developing relationships. Really, the way I like to look at it is building and growing community through food. And those are the connections that all of a sudden just the floodgates open. This guy knows a goose farmer. This person has lamb over here. This person is raising some rabbits. This guy has a couple of goats. We're buying a bison in February. So we're always going down that path. That's really the biggest difference. That's why we taste like Italy. Even though beef is raised here, chicken is raised here, the herbs are grown here, all of those perishables are from here, but the technique and the method behind it, it's a lot harder to do and it's not cheaper, I will tell you that, but it is far more rewarding. And I think I would not be a chef if I did this any other way because I would not be interested in doing it.
Building that relationship supply chain, if you will, that takes time. And I want that to segue, I think, into your latest venture in opening Stefano's Slow Food Market. Can you talk about the inspiration from that and how you view the slow food movement?
For me, the slow food movement is kind of what I just touched on a little bit. Like you said, it's a good segue. For example, we just brought in a new prosciutto called Pio Ticini Prosciutto. It ages 100 days longer than any other prosciutto in Italy. It is not pressed, so it's called legato, which is actually a musical term, which you probably know, which means smooth and sort of, you know, fluid. But it's a much more bulbous and large prosciutto. So all of these things that we do, all of these products and things, it takes no more time to slice that piece of prosciutto than it does an inferior piece of prosciutto. So for me, I've always migrated towards the most sort of platonic ideal of an ingredient. I want the best prosciutto. I want the best mortadella. I want the best raw sheep milk cheeses from Abruzzo and from Tuscany. And that hunt for those things and honoring those things, that's a big, big part of what we're doing. It's just the idea that we're giving you, hopefully, a product that was raised. It took a little longer to raise, maybe had to go a little further afield to get it. And then we can give you those things. That's why our logo is a snail on a skateboard, because, yeah, the snail is slow, but he's riding on a skateboard. So he's quick. And it's a kind of a goofy logo, but I love it. You know, yes, it takes longer and it costs more sometimes to get these products, but it's a fight that I am more than willing to fight. Because it, when you taste it and put it in your mouth, that's what it's about to me right now. So the real Italian cooking, and I've been blessed enough to be in kitchens all over Italy and cook in these places, but generally I tend to seek out the nonas and the women in general. I've just had much better experience. They seem to be the key holders and the gatekeepers to tradition. And so I really tend to cook with them, but it is all about where is it from? It can't be made better by putting these seven things on it. So don't put them on it and let it be. And so that's really why I went the way I went in my sourcing for 30 years now, is because you learn that. You can't do better than Mother Nature and a really good farmer.
Stefano, thank you for the conversation and thank you so much for joining us.
You're so very welcome. I had a blast.
That was Stefano Viglietti, a self-taught chef who owns and operates three restaurants and a market with his spouse and business partner, Whitney Viglietti, in Sheboygan. And earlier, we talked with Grazia Menichella, chair of the Department of French and Italian at UW-Madison, as we explored the global importance of Italian cooking traditions and their place in Wisconsin.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, actor Willem Dafoe is from Appleton. He joins the show to talk about his new movie and his experiences in Wisconsin, including an experimental theater company in Milwaukee.
We were people who lived, ate, breathed theater, and that was a really formative experience for me. My time in Milwaukee was very happy. I liked Milwaukee a lot.
Willem Dafoe is next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This Christmas, a brand new remake of the iconic 1922 German vampire film Nosferatu will hit theaters more than 100 years since the premiere of the original.
The film stars Wisconsin-born actor Willem Dafoe as Professor Alban Eberhard von Franz.
I have seen things in this world that would have made Isaac Newton crawl back into his mother's womb. We have not become so much enlightened as we have been blinded by the gaseous light of science. I have wrestled with the devil as Jacob wrestled the angel in Peniel. And I tell you, if we are to tame darkness, we must first face that it exists.
Dafoe has appeared in more than 150 films and received 4 Oscar nominations over the course of his career.
I talked to him last week about his new film and how his time in Appleton and Milwaukee shaped him as an actor. Willem, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Sure.
Nosferatu, classic movie theme. What makes this new take on that tradition stand out to you?
Well, it's a Robert Eggers film for a start, and he's a very singular filmmaker, the way he approaches period films. It's a passion project for him. It's not a straight licks remake. It's a personal film. One big difference is in the telling of the story, we experience it through the character of Ellen, played by Lily Rose Depp. We experience it through her eyes, which is quite unique.
And this is your third go, by my count, with Robert Eggers. What keeps you coming back?
Your count's good. he just gives me fun things to do. He challenges me. He knows actors' language. He knows how to trigger, get the best out of me. And the sets that he makes are so beautiful, they're so precise that they really help you to inhabit these characters. He's a great writer. He does incredible research. All of his movies are very rooted. Nothing's indicated. Nothing's pointed at. Nothing's shown. You can really enter these period films and experience it with the characters, and they feel relevant today, even though they're set in another time. These are not museum pieces. They're living stories that he's a great believer in.
And Professor von Franz, you are in that classic vampire hunter role of Van Helsing-ish character. How did you tackle this?
Well, he's sort of an invented character. You're right. He sort of functions as the Van Helsing character, but I think he's much more than that. He's an occultist. He's someone that's involved in alchemy and mystical things, and he's the only character that really sees what the Ellen character is going through. And why that is significant is he gives another perspective, because everyone else just thinks she's possessed and they want to solve the problem. But he posits the idea that you have to recognize the dark side to appreciate the light. The light doesn't exist without the dark. And he is a person that is studied at exploring the unseen and studied at wondering what is beyond this life that we have. So he's not just a hunter. He also brings another dynamic to the film.
This is a horror genre type of film. And more than that, I would say, I don't think of you as a horror actor, but growing up as a kid in Appleton, what was your relationship with horror films?
I think I used to go to the Viking Theater in Appleton, Wisconsin, and one of my favorite memories is going to see horror movies, to tell you the truth. And also, my parents would occasionally get time to make it down to Chicago, and they'd bring back these little 8mm films that were reductions of classic, like Hammer films and with Boris Karloff and Vincent Price. And I really grew up on those. So somewhere that was a huge part of my earliest cinema experiences.
Was there a favorite actor or role from those early days of watching horror movies that really stuck with you?
It would have to be Boris Karloff as Frankenstein.
Why?
Well, first of all, the Frankenstein story is one that really stayed with me. His transformation was interesting. And then I would also know him from The Mummy. So I wasn't just stuck on one image of him. He was just a very interesting actor, I think.
We're talking to Wisconsin's own Willem Dafoe. He's in Nosferatu out Christmas Day. Now, you've mentioned elsewhere seeing movies at the Downer Historic Theater in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, sure.
Talk about that a little bit and what it told you about the cinema world.
Well, what was beautiful about the Downer was they showed foreign films and they showed some art movies. And I can't quite remember, but they also showed some the earliest, independent movies. I may be wrong. I got to check on my time here, but I may have seen Pink Flamingos there when I was a kid. And I also remember seeing some of my first foreign films there. So that was very important. The Downer was cool.
Also in Milwaukee, you were at Theater X, an experimental company. I see a lot of versatility, of course, in your career, the variety of roles you've played. How did something like Theater X set you on that road?
What was beautiful about that, it was a group theater that actually made original work. Sometimes we'd do plays, but often we had a playwright in residence who would also direct the plays. So it was a small company. We had a theater on Water Street, very close to where the Performing Arts Center is now. I was there for a couple of years. It was a great experience. We were people who lived, ate, breathed theater. We'd go to work every day making work. We'd toured a little bit, and that was really a formative experience for me. And my time in Milwaukee was very happy. I liked Milwaukee a lot.
You also did experimental theater work in New York. When you're coming into a role, like in Nosferatu, do you find yourself drawing on lessons from those early days on stage?
Certainly, my 27 years with the Wooster Group in New York City really formed me as a cinema actor, particularly because we worked with a certain amount of technology, and in that theater that also made original work, the technicians were as important as the actors. They were almost interchangeable with the actors because the actors had technical tasks and the technicians had actor tasks. So that was also very useful for me accepting the technical responsibilities you sometimes have in cinema. Because in cinema, you sometimes have to have a double focus. You have to be doing what the character is doing, but also you have to submit to certain technical structures and limitations and rules. And I learned how to do that with pleasure, because that allows you to focus better. If you don't have a structure, if you don't have kind of guardrails, I think you can tend to sit in things too much and be too egocentric in your performing. This really forces you out of yourself and gives you so many responsibilities that you can't fall out of the scene. You're always there. The presence of the actor is really the most important thing, I think, in cinema acting and in theater acting.
And that brings it back home to Nosferatu. You mentioned Robert Eggers and how he sets the scenes. Can you talk about how you as an actor, how you keep yourself in that scene and integrate that technical side into what you're doing in front of the camera?
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting about him is when we arrive, we do rehearsal, but we don't talk about character. We don't really do scene study. He shows us a very specific design of what the camera is going to see. And we rehearse, but we rehearse folding into the camera movement. It's very complicated. And sometimes you have 7, 8 people in one shot that goes on a very long time. And everybody has to work together, be very precise in the marks they hit, be very precise in the relationship to the movement and to each other. And what that does is not only does it create a kind of complicity and cooperation among everyone, but also it ups the stakes because nobody can make a mistake. You've got to live and die with that shot. So you really work for there's no such thing as absolute perfection, but you work for a relative perfection. And when you have that kind of challenge, it really focuses you. That way you don't fall out of the scene. The scene has a kind of energy and a kind of tension and a kind of focus that can only come when you have a lot to do and you can't do anything but what you're required to do.
Willem, thanks so much for joining us back in Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you. Say hello to Wisconsin.
Willem Dafoe is an Appleton-born actor who has appeared in more than 150 films and received 4 Oscar nominations over the course of his career. He stars as Professor Alban Eberhard von Franz in the upcoming film Nosferatu in theaters Christmas Day. Now for a look at vampires in movies and media throughout history, we're joined by Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. Jocelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. It's always great to chat with you.
All right, we'd had the vampire myth around for centuries, and then we had Bram Stoker writing Dracula. And then here's Nosferatu, bringing it to the screen, the oldest, at least oldest surviving vampire movie we have. What was Nosferatu's wrinkle on the vampire legend?
Well, Murnau and the other creators of Nosferatu wanted to essentially make Dracula, but they didn't get the copyright. And this was actually a big problem because Bram Stoker was, he had died by this point, but like his wife definitely was not pleased about this. So there was a whole suit. It was a giant mess. Essentially what had to happen was that they had to change the name to Nosferatu. But if you watch the original Nosferatu, I mean, 1922, it's really creepy. It's great. But the storyline is very, very similar to Bram Stoker's original novel. So that's kind of a funny thing about it, that it's not Dracula, but it kind of is Dracula at the same time.
And I understand a lawsuit was successful in Germany. Most copies of Nosferatu were destroyed. But in the United States, their laws are a little different, and one copy survives there. So it wasn't a sure thing that we would have the original Nosferatu to watch today, right?
Exactly. And I think that really speaks to some of the benefits of global distribution. You know, we often think about it as maybe a little bit problematic. It's like the United States spreading its own approach to, at this time, film culture around the world. But here we have an example of a masterpiece that would have been completely lost to time if there didn't happen to be this little wrinkle in the laws in the US. And it's kind of funny when you think about it, because Dracula as a figure, he's also somebody who crosses borders, right? He comes from Transylvania over to England, right? And brings this kind of like fear with him. So in a way, it's kind of like a perfect story for thinking about Dracula himself as somebody who also is able to cross borders with rapidity, just like media is able to do.
What is it about the vampire legend that is so effective, that keeps us coming back again and again, whether it's in a book or on the big screen?
I think I'll speak to why vampires are so appealing in terms of the big screen. And that's because they're really cinematic villains. First of all, you know, we think of them, they can be horrifying, like the Max Schreck Nosferatu or later iterations of Nosferatu, or they can be these really kind of debonair, attractive vampires like Christopher Lee in the Hammer series of Dracula films. So we've already got somebody who might have movie star looks, might have this kind of like seductive element around them, which of course is always catnip for the movies. But in addition to that, vampires are a great way to show off your special effects. What happens with vampires? Well, there's no reflection. So that's a great way to use movie magic for spectators to see, oh my gosh, there's no reflection in this mirror. That's amazing. Vampires turn into bats, so you can showcase some of your excellent creature effects. So I think of vampires as actually very, very cinematic creatures because they can show off all of the wonderful things that special effects technicians can do.
Do you think the meaning of vampires to the viewing public changes over time?
Oh, most definitely. Absolutely. So I referenced Christopher Lee's portrayals of Dracula in a whole series of Hammer films. And I highly recommend actually watching all of those in succession, because they come out over a period of about 15 to 18 years from the early 60s until the mid 70s. And you can watch how Dracula changes from this kind of like gothic count, your standard Dracula that we might think of immediately, into somebody who's involved with the counterculture, a group of people that the mainstream might have been a little bit afraid of, right? Like counterculture youths. And that is a particularly amazing transition to watch there.
You have a special interest in vampires. Big new vampire movies coming out. I assume you're going to see it when it hits the screen.
I'm really, really excited to see Nosferatu. I can be a little bit suspicious of remakes, but I have to say the trailer for this just looks fantastic. And who can say no to the great Willem Dafoe, hometown hero and one of the greatest living actors that we have.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is associate professor and director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, author of the book Movies Under the Influence. She has a cat named after a character from the Dracula book, by the way. She joined us for a look at vampire movies throughout history. And earlier we spoke with Wisconsin-born actor Willem Dafoe about his role in the upcoming film Nosferatu.
As we heard on the show today, Wisconsin has a rich history in Italian cooking, with a woman in Janesville in the early 1900s publishing an influential book about Italian cooking designed for American families that's still in use today.
You can share your own story about ethnic cuisines and recipes that have been passed down in your family and how they're part of your meals, your traditions, maybe your holiday traditions to this day.
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232 to share your cooking traditions and stories that are going on now in the holiday season and throughout the year.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.